Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI launches three separate appeals at the end of the Sunday Angelus prayer in St. Peter's Square. Salesian Father Julian Fox tells us about the charism and the mission of his order as Salesians worldwide are gathered here in Rome for their 26th General Chapter. We hear how Lent has been drained of its spiritual element by secularization and the disappearance of seasons. And Father Jim Brand continues in his Lenten meditations and reflects on the battle between life and death, between light and darkness. The fate of a Chaldean Catholic archbishop kidnapped in Iraq, the spiral of deaths in renewed fighting in the Holy Land, and the defence of childhood were chief among Pope Benedict XVI's concerns this Sunday as he launched three separate appeals at the end of the midday Angelus prayer. Emma McCarthy has more.
Speaking to a crowd in St. Peter's Square from the window of the papal apartments, the Pope turned first to Iraq, where Friday last the Chaldean Catholic Archbishop of Mosul was abducted and his driver and bodyguards ruthlessly killed by masked gunmen.
Con profonda tristezza, seguo la drammatica vicenda del rapimento di Monsignor Paolo Sfara Erajo, Arcivescovo di Mosul dei Caldei in Iraq.
The Holy Father called on the abductors to free the 65-year-old archbishop, who, the Pope noted, is in poor health. He said his prayers were offered in suffrage for the souls of the three young family men who were with him at the time of his abduction. The Pope also expressed his spiritual closeness to the entire church in Iraq, particularly the Chaldean church, which, he said, has once again been so harshly targeted. Pope Benedict encouraged both pastors and faithful to remain strong and anchored to hope, urging all those who hold the fate of the Iraqi people in their hands to redouble their efforts so that lasting security and peace are found and that no one is denied their right to a future. Pope Benedict XVI's thoughts then turned to the Holy Land, where renewed fighting between Israelis and Palestinians have left over 60 people dead, among them many civilians and children.
Rinnovo il mio pressante invito alle autorità, sia israeliane che palestinesi.
The Pope appealed to Israeli and Palestinian authorities to end this cycle of violence unilaterally and unconditionally. He said only by showing absolute respect for human life, even that of the enemy, will it be possible to hope for a future of peace and coexistence for the young generations of these two peoples.
Un futuro di pace e di convivenza alle giovani generazioni di quei popoli.
The Holy Father's final appeal, he said, was a cry in favour of childhood.
Noti come Ciccio e Tore.
The Pope was referring to a recent episode which has shocked the entire nation of Italy. In a tragic epilogue to the case of two missing brothers, familiarly known as Ciccio and Tore, their broken bodies were found this week lying one beside the other at the bottom of a 25-metre shaft in an abandoned warehouse. The two boys, aged 11 and 13 at the time of their disappearance, had been missing for over 20 months.
Prendiamoci cura dei piccoli. Bisogna amarli e aiutarli a crescere.
In a passionate appeal, Pope Benedict XVI said, we must take care of our children. I say this not only to parents, but to institutions too. In launching this appeal, my thoughts go out to the children of the world, above all to children who are defenseless, exploited and abused. I entrust each and every child to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, who said, let the children come unto me.
Thanks to Emma McCarthy for that report. One of the news items highlighted by Vatican Radio's weekly information service regards the fact that the Salesian congregation is holding its 26th general chapter on the theme Da mihi animas, cetera tolle. Give me souls, take away all else. That's the motto chosen by St. John Bosco, the founder of the congregation, whose mission it is to be bearers of the love of God for young people, especially for those who are poor. The ongoing General Chapter means there are Salesians from all over the world gathered at the Salesian Generalate House here in Rome. And as far as I'm concerned, The theme made me really curious to find out something more about them.
The congregation is about 150 years now, or close on 150 years in existence.
Father Julian Fox is secretary to the Department for Communications at the Salesian Generalate House.
Don Bosco worked for young people in and around Turin and gathered lots of youngsters at what is known as the Oratory in Valdocco in Turin. From those young people that he gathered, he formed people who wanted to stay with him. They became the first Salesians, in other words. From there, the congregation spread very rapidly throughout, obviously throughout Italy as it became, and throughout Europe. The first missionaries were sent to South America, particularly to Argentina, Patagonia, during Don Bosco's lifetime. And from there, we have spread into approximately 130 nations of the world.
I also discovered that Don Bosco named the congregation after St. Francis de Sales, who was known for his kind and gentle manner, a trait which he wanted his Salesians to acquire. And for a very good reason. Now, I understand that obviously your main mission is to evangelize, but the Salesians are universally recognized as great teachers. Is that true?
Correct. Certainly, we're recognized, I would think, for the core of our charism, which is the preventive system, a way of educating with the heart, through the heart. In other words, Don Bosco developed a whole set of intuitions and practices which he called the preventive system. It wasn't actually a term that he invented. He took it from the language and practice of his time, but he changed it into a style of presence, particularly of being with young people that, well, we have discovered in those 150 years enculturates very easily anywhere in the world.
Yes, the Salesians can be found worldwide in many different initiatives on behalf of young people. Schools, oratories, youth centres, technical and professional training centres, parishes, foreign missions, and activities that have to do with mass media and social communications. I just happen to have personal knowledge of one of these. I have been in Africa often. I'm from Africa originally, and I've been to Salesian missions. And what has really struck me every time is that there's always a football field. There's always a room to play games as well.
Exactly. In other words, he changed the understanding of oratory, which is a word which means prayer in Latin, from a place where you simply gathered to pray to a place where you gathered to play, and through play you were introduced to prayer. He describes the oratory, in fact, as a place where people feel at home. He describes it as a playground where friends meet. He describes it as a parish, as a church, where people obviously come together in that context. So he determined the concept of oratory in a new way. And so you correct it, you'll find a football or whatever, and Salesians in the midst of young people. Yeah, that's characteristic of our style, I guess.
Right now you're holding your general chapter, which, as you mentioned earlier, goes on for about a month. What is the objective of this chapter?
General chapters, this is the 26th in the history of the congregation. General chapters tend to have a particular theme. This one is return to Don Bosco, not in any general sort of a way, but to return very particularly to the heart of the charism, which is the preventive system.
The preventive system, Father Julian explained, is not really a system at all, but a lifestyle, an educational approach, a pastoral method and a spiritual heritage. But at this point, I found myself wondering, what made Father Julian, an Australian by the sound of his accent, become part of the Salesian family?
I suspect precisely what we've been talking about. In other words, I went to a Salesian school as a youngster, and I was immediately attracted by the style, by the people, by the appeal to the heart. So educating with the heart was something that that intuitively made sense to me, and it just stayed that way.
It's really quite a joyful approach, isn't it?
It is, yes. It's yeah, and I guess that's part of the charism. It's it is joyful. Don Bosco put it, of course, in the language of his the religious languages of his own time, that he wanted them to be happy here and happy in eternity. He spoke about producing good Christians and honest citizens. He had lots of these little phrases, but that's a very catchy one and one that works very well across any culture.
And across the world and within many different cultures, the over 16,000 priests, brothers, sisters and lay people who belong to the Salesian family have founded schools, set up churches, oratories and missions with the goal of giving children and young people a chance for a full life, continuing in the clear and simple mission of St. John Bosco, to be a friend to children who are poor, who are abandoned, who are at risk, and in doing so, to be a friend of Christ. What about yourself personally? What are your hopes?
I obviously feel that this particular general chapter has caught the imagination of every Salesian in the world. We have an extraordinarily charismatic and excellent leader in Father Pascual Chavez, and he has this capacity to catch the moment. And I think that this recall to educate with the heart of Don Bosco is something that has inspired and fired the members of the congregation. So my hopes are that it meets the moment because, like any other congregation in the world, you know, we have to go looking for our vocations, obviously, even though we're large in numbers. And so this will help, I think, to reinforce our own vocation and also to continue to attract others.
I was surfing the internet the other day when I came across a somewhat different article on Lent. This is how it started. An alien question to today's younger generation is, what are you giving up for Lent? No child of my acquaintance, it continued, gives up anything for Lent. Nor have my generation of parents ever exacted or enforced the custom. Partly, the article explained, because we did not really favour privations. The Stoic tradition has died with the introduction of central heating, and partly, it continued, because the shopping and consumer culture is inherently hostile to anything like a Lenten practice. I skimmed to the bottom of the article to find the author and discovered it is Mary Kenny, columnist for the Catholic Herald and author. Immediately I wrote her an email asking whether she would agree to speak to me about her ideas. And immediately she replied and told me that to start with, she was probably thinking back to her childhood in Ireland, where there was a much more stoical attitude to various privations.
Although we did have heating in the wintertime, nevertheless, you were not encouraged to turn on the heating until it got really quite cold. This also obtained, actually, in English public schools as well, where it was considered that a little bit of suffering in terms of cold baths and the like are good for you. Now, I mean, everything in moderation is the golden rule, but I think that we have slightly lost the sense of actually depriving ourselves sometimes of small comforts and small pleasures, simply because it probably is rather good for our characters not to have everything all at once. And it rather shocks me in England to see today that Easter eggs are for sale in the stores long before Lent has started, and that children are automatically given Easter eggs long before Lent has started. And it seems to me that we've sort of lost the sense of do without for a little bit, and then you will have the reward.
One interesting point you make is that contemporary technology has ruined all sense of season. The disappearance of seasons in food means that the seasonal rhythm of Lent also disintegrates in a way.
Indeed, I mean, Lent was, of course, based on the sort of natural rhythm of the year and the way in which the winter stocks would be beginning to run out by February and March, and then would come the spring, and of course we would have the Paschal lamb and so on at that time of the year, and the hens would begin to lay again. So that, I mean, quite a lot of religious law is linked to natural law anyway. But we have a different concept today. We've got the microwave and we've got the deep freeze, and we have strawberries in winter, and we have fresh peas flown to us from deepest Africa using all that carbon footprint. So we tend not to have such a sense of the rhythm of the seasons anyway. It was actually the cookery writer Delia Smith who has written about this quite a lot as well, and the way in which she finds that a lot of school children have kind of lost sense with the roots of food anyway. I mean, chickens in England don't even come with giblets anymore, so that the child gets the idea that a chicken is something which comes from the supermarket shelf, whereas older people could remember the time when, you know, you had to pluck the chicken and eviscerate it before you actually cooked it. And again, this is not an argument for keeping women at the kitchen sink doing all these things, but if we lose a sense of our connection with the way nature produces food and the rhythm of the seasons, I think that we do lose touch with some sort of core sense of our own rhythm as well.
Another interesting point Mary makes is that there are very few everyday references in the secular world of the Lenten season, and that there is widespread ignorance as regards the meaning of Shrove Tuesday or Mardi Gras, although there are differences from country to country.
The northern countries had a much more residual approach to this, and Pancake Tuesday or Shrove Tuesday was, in a way, I suppose, a Protestant concession to the Mardi Gras idea. But that has almost completely disappeared, and there was a poll taken this year in Britain which showed that I think 2/3 of people didn't know what Shrove Tuesday was, and they no longer mark even the pancake. Again, a pancake is something which now you can have at any time, and there's no particular significance to it. I have to some degree, blame the church itself, I think, for these changes, because I think that the Catholic Church could have held on a little bit more to the dietary rules. After Vatican II in the 1960s, there was a shift to sort of say, look, stop giving up things all the time, and instead, why not do something very positive, such as save for the poor and so on. And that's a very good thing. But I think that in trying to shift towards a different emphasis, the ideas behind the fasting and abstinence were actually lost, and thus they've almost culturally disappeared. And I suppose I'm contrasting a very different world again in Ireland, which was a very Catholic country in the 1950s and 1960s. For example, people didn't get married during Lent except by a very, very special license. And there were hardly any dances during Lent. So there was a general community feeling of having this period of self-sacrifice, if you like. But on the other hand, it did knit the community together, and it did make people feel they were doing something in a community spirit. And therefore, the dances and the weddings that came after Lent were particularly joyful.
Many church-sponsored Lenten campaigns today ask us to contribute funds to overseas development as part of our Lenten exercise, which is all very well. But there is something in this that makes you uncomfortable, you say, because it deprives us of the spirit of Lent.
That's all very much part of the secular culture now anyway. In Great Britain we have things like Comic Relief Day, where comedians come on television and do funny things, and it's all for good causes. That's all absolutely admirable and excellent. But that has very much become the territory of the secular culture, and therefore it doesn't really impinge in any way in terms of our developing a spiritual life of our own, which is what part of the Lenten exercises were about, was that it was to cause you to reflect upon your own life. And that's not just in Christianity. I mean, it's in several other religions, and I think the church has let go of that too much and too easily, and really should restore the sense of our carrying out certain dietary exercises and certain personal privations for the sake of our own spirituality.
Your anthropological analysis is very interesting, and it's actually very easy to follow because everything you say is so tangible. But at the end, what you say, the spirit of Lent is dead because the spiritual element has been so thoroughly removed.
Well, perhaps it's a little bit indulging in hyperbole to say that the spirit of Lent is dead, but it certainly has diminished enormously. And I don't think things ever die, because I do think there's always a revival and people come to appreciate that many of the old traditions, which were there for a very good reason, deserve to be revived. And I think that it's quite possible, you know, we will see a kind of revival. But I think that we have let go far too easily and far too much of the actual spirit of Lent, which had a very, very good purpose, both in spiritual life, in community life, and I would also say in things like character building. You know, we have a lot of concerns today about children getting far too many expensive toys too quickly, too easily, and in consequence of this, that they're not really happy, that they're over-pampered with material things and yet not able to appreciate sometimes the simple things. There are many concerned, not by church people necessarily, but by psychologists and by social analysts. And I think that there again, if we had understood the point that less is more sometimes, if you save up for something, it's sweeter. Deferred gratification is part of the whole notion of valuing something. So that I think we've lost more than the spiritual in letting go of so many Lenten practices. I think we've lost a lot of psychological and indeed sociological phenomena as well, which were part of the sort of building blocks of our society and indeed of our culture.
Thank you very much, Mary. There's one thought that came to my mind as you were speaking. At the very beginning, you mentioned the carbon footprint. And I was thinking, in this evolution, maybe some other elements have converged to become important in this period of the year. There are a lot of Lenten campaigns are dedicated to climate change this year. Do you have any thought about that?
Well, I think that's quite interesting, because I think that is quite often old ideas coming out in new livery. And, I mean, I'm not at all against some of these campaigns, because quite honestly, they are quite often just repetitions of the kind of ideas that my mother, my grandmother would have had about waste. And I am really quite shocked sometimes to see the amount of waste in my own garbage every week, and the amount of packaging, and really the sinfulness too of so much food thrown away and so much abundance wasted. And I think that if there is a new Puritanism which is objecting to that, it's no bad thing. And you're right that several other areas, if you like, of health-related issues tend to reassert themselves during Lent. For example, Ash Wednesday now has been taken up by no smoking campaigners. They ask people not to smoke on Ash Wednesday, or to use Ash Wednesday as a reason to sort of give up cigarettes. There's nothing wrong with that either. But again, in our traditions of Lent, I think we mingled the notion of the body and the soul together, and that, you know, the healthy body and the healthy mind was interlinked. Whereas with the secular campaigns, they're almost wholly focused on the body, and that is missing out again the spiritual and indeed the psychological dimension.
You've been listening to Mary Kenny, author and columnist for the Catholic Herald. And now Father Jim Brand, spiritual director at the Pontifical Beta College, continues in his Lenten meditations and reflects on the battle between light and darkness.
Hello, Father Jim here. Next Sunday is the fifth Sunday of Lent. And this year we're going to hear how our Lord would go to the grave himself and be raised by the Father. And so, in him and with him and through him, all of us have an eternal human life. For death will be real, but not the end of the story at all. So we have the raising of Lazarus, which was really the crunch thing that the authorities had to face one way or the other. How do they see this? Somebody who brings life to the dead. And in Holy Week, we have to remember our Lord did enter death. And death is death. Can't laugh that one off. But the Father's raised him up. And so now Jesus isn't a has-been. He is. And you and I believe that although we're going to follow him in death, we, please God, will follow him into eternal life. How nice to think that we have an eternal future with him. So here is from Piers Plowman by William Langland, a very strong little poem about the crucifixion and how we have to wait for the Easter Sunday call of the trumpet. The trumpet shall sound, and we shall be raised again. The crucifixion. String him up, some reprimand shouted. He's a weirdo. In the bin, in the bin, yelled another and grabbed some thorns. Sharp as needles, twisting them round a fresh-cut thorn branch, he made a wreath and forced it down in his head. The pain piercing his flesh. Morning, vicar, this comedian said, and darted twigs at him, aiming at his eyes. With three nails, he nailed him naked to a cross, lifted bitter drink to his lips, telling him, drink, and stop dropping off. Hang on a bit longer. Now, if he's really something, he said, he'll get himself out of this one. If you're Christ, and if Christ is God's son, come on down off that cross. We'll believe it then. You've got life on a string. You're never going to be a goner. That's it. Christ said, that's it. His senses began to fade, pale and piteous. Like a prisoner in death, the Lord of life and light closed his eyes. Day shrank back, appalled, and the sun darkened. The temple walls shattered and split. The solid rocks of earth ruptured. It was dark as thickest night. Earth convulsed, quaked like a live thing. The noise brought dead men clambering up from the coffined depths, who told why the tempest raged so long. One corpse said, there is in darkness here a bitter fight. Life and death destroy each other. None can know for sure who wins till Sunday, as the sun rises. And with these words sank back in earth. Yes, the battle is still going on between life and death and light and darkness. We labour for the light. We labour for life, praying and hoping and working that the light will always overcome darkness, and life will always overcome death. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.